So we move from Earth into the experience of our own subjective life, which, when we first encounter it, is a confusion of thought and feeling and memory and image. It isn't presented like this. It's an amalgam. It's a spinning wheel of stuff. And normally, the reason the confusion was there in the beginning is because we haven't got any Earth. This is just spinning on its own, out of relationship, really affected by things from the outside, so that when we're very lost in ourselves, in our sense of ourselves, any encounter from inside and outside takes us into this spin, this mess of stuff. What we do as we become more and more present in our bodies, we create connection between the mind and the body, feelings and body. We start to create a holding frame instead of this just spinning out of control in all kinds of mess. We start to slow everything down. So we slow down the mind, we start to slow down the feelings, we start to slow down the imagination. At the same time as we're doing this down here in this outer place, in the deepest place, this is the sort of my very own self, the ipsissimus bit of us, is up there, or deep in there rather, sort of in the deepest place, continually reaching out towards us. Now that place, which is the kind of deepest place in our being in a way, reaches out through, it has these qualities here of archetypal feminine, like the womb energy, the primal imagination, deep imagination, or the capacity to create. Here is, we could say, is the prime will. And here's just the deep center. Now these things are always in union, because it's above this place called the abyss, which is the place of separation. So this is the abyss, and the place where there's a sense of profound separation. Bridging the abyss is this place called Da'at, which means the knowing of not knowing, the sense of mystery that the body can bridge, but not the mind. But at the same time, we're reaching up, if you like, from the outer place. From this place, reaching down is a messenger. This is the angel. The angel sort of appears here. It's given the image of the sun. It's a center point of balance. It's connected with these other qualities here of clarity and love. So this is Mars and Jupiter. This forms another little triangle of possibility. And this is reaching down through the spin here. Now the connection between here and here, they say there's something called the veil of the temple between it. And that veil is caused by the spin of thought, emotion and memory and image. Right, so what we're doing, what we've done today, yesterday, is we get present, come into our bodies, come into a sense of containment and the intention to look inward. We create a holding frame and we're trying to listen to what's coming out of the deeper place. What we're trying to do is to connect, if you like, the sort of the surface energies up with the deeper energies. So the mind can go into all kinds of tangles of its own, but if it connects to the deeper energy of clarity, the mind gets direction, the mind gets kind of becomes concentrated and can focus. Feelings are spinning all over the place. If they connect up with the idea of compassion and love, and there's a sort of acceptance, a warmth that comes into our feelings. And gradually, little by little, as we keep interacting with this, keep trusting the images, keep going into the deeper places, what starts to happen is that sun energy starts to irradiate the moon, Mercury, and Venus. It starts to bring that deeper quality of presence to them. And what that does is a further holding frame around the spin. Now the spin is still going on, but it's getting connected up all the time. Now this is happening all the time, but all the time what's happening is it's getting obscured and broken. Right, so the trouble with doing this is a flat diagram. It looks like, okay, that's what it is, you fix it, but actually it's a dynamic. So all the time that we're kind of trying to go in, we're hitting resistances, we're bouncing out. All the time there is a deep sense that the descent of the angel, one of the images they have is the descent of the angel into the pool of Yesod, into the foundations of your being. It's to reorganize the foundations of your being. To reorganize your relationship to your sense of self, your sense of world, your thinking and your feeling. And that's the sort of alchemical work of that we're going to be looking at this year. So it's the thing that the bards were talking about, and because where it takes us to eventually is a sense of, is this place up here where we're working with the deep sense of identity there, the sense of who we are, working with the will that arises out of that, and working with the deep imagination, the deep creativity that's in the archetypal feminine. And this is a place, in a sense, where we're sort of connected to the deepest sense of ourselves, the clearest expression of our own will and our own creativity, that can then manifest with clarity and love and a sense of balance and express itself through thought, feeling and image and bodily sensation. So that process that we go in, and then we come out all the way, expressing whatever is at the deep. So for the little bit of work we did yesterday, Penny, it was all where one of the places that, so you'd gone down, that was fine, and hadn't quite come back, brought it all the way back out.
Yeah.
It was a really lovely expression of bringing it out, because what happened is you started to smile, and your body opened up, and there was a real sense of energy and life coming through you. Okay, what we all have, and we're all individualists, is we have particular blocks and boundaries and messed up places at different points of the circuit. So sometimes it's very difficult to go in. Having got in, it's sometimes very difficult to come out. Or maybe we can get partly in, maybe we can only get partly out. So part of the art of this year is really trying to understand, not just helping the flow, but to understand wherever the places where flow gets blocked and how can we help that. The key kind of process in it, in some ways, is to try and trust whatever's happening. And that's easy enough to say. It's actually very hard to do. It's kind of, because actually what happens is, we all have these really relentless voices that tell us we're doing it wrong and that compare us to other people. There's something about trusting, manifesting and trusting our own shape. It's being Kadir Idris and not a tower when we think we've got to be a tower. And it's complicated. If we think we've got to be a tower, but actually we're really Kadir Idris, and we're Kadir Idris trying to be a tower. Kadir, to become a tower, has to really push itself in and make itself more separate and much more linear than Kadir Idris is. So that form, the tower form, will be, if you try and pack Kadir Idris into a tower, the tower is going to be under enormous pressure because its shape doesn't match its underlying nature, because its underlying nature wants to burst out and to create connection. And that's generally speaking true for all of us. We have created, to one degree or other, created a shape, necessarily created that shape because we've done it to keep ourselves safe in relationship to whatever we found. So it's not that the shape that we have is wrong, But it's at this point, as we apply ourselves to that kind of deeper energy, one of the things, as that energy is freed, as the prisoner, if we come back to the poem, as the prisoner starts to emerge out of the prison, well, something then has to change. The world has to break open to some degree. So the sense of who we are and the sense of a world it gets shaken, and that's very difficult. Because however complicated or difficult the shape we've created is, we've created it because it suited us. And in some ways it still suits us, but actually it doesn't suit us enough, otherwise the shape wouldn't be under pressure. So in a way, the core process of this year, in a sense, the key process is to just do this and to really find out about this, to really look at this movement from the outside place to creating a root and an anchor, to entering the pool of our own subjectivity and working with the wheel of resistance and thought and feeling and image, to come to more deeply know and converse with the angel, and then let that figure take us into the kind of the deeper place where we just have to surrender, to bridge across the abyss. You just have to let go and trust that somehow being there will bridge it. And so it's a complicated business, really, because we have to work as if we're in control of the process, because we are, you know, that's to a certain extent we are. But actually, more deeply, we're just in the hands of the deeper place. And the question really, the choice really is whether do we cooperate with that or do we fight it? You know, the reality is it's whatever's going on is going on. If we cooperate with it, it goes better, because that sense of alignment and realignment that needs to happen doesn't have to blow through so much resistance if we're helping to soften the resistance at our end. And the thing is, we never know what's going to happen. Trusting the process is really kind of important, but it's quite difficult because and it's not, because we're not in control. Before, you know, sort of however many years ago, it was 2000, I think I just stopped doing anything other than just being self-employed. But the thing that got, I mean, I'd been agonizing about leaving and being self-employed. I'd been a therapist, you know, for 10 years before that. So thinking, shall I get self-employed? Shall I not? What shall I do? And, you know, and really kind of struggling with it. But the moment when it happened was when I stood up in front of a whole load of training managers and watched myself lie to them and watched them believe me. Now, that's an example, I think, of something orchestrated by the guardian, by my holy guardian angel, where suddenly, I was up against, and there's always a serious choice point at that point, where the thing that horrified me was how good I was at lying. I was lying for the government. I was kind of convincing them that something was good that was terrible. And so that moment of seeing them nod and thinking, oh shit, they believe me. And realizing I was good at it, I was good at lying for the government. You know, and I was offered, you know, and I left the government job, I was being offered a really incredibly well-paid job. And But somehow, if you like, that deeper place had orchestrated something where I could have chosen to abandon the deeper place altogether and chase the money. But it would have been very difficult for me to do that, because there was something about that combination of circumstances. Because of course I felt really uncomfortable at other times. See, it's not like I never felt uncomfortable of having to get up and lie for the government. But I think truthfully that it was seeing them believe me that got me. It's like I felt comfortable lying for the government while I thought they didn't, nobody's going to believe this. We all know we're playing some game here. But it was noticing that I'd got through to them, and noticing that I was quite good at how I'd put it, and I'd, quite good at giving speeches. And I just saw it worked, and I thought it was just something so awful about that moment. And in a way, that's the great thing about all this. Particularly when we think, oh God, I can't get through things, I know I'm not useless at working on myself. Also, actually, it's not in our hands. All we do is we do our best to cooperate, but actually there is something deeper running the show. So in a way, what we're doing as we apply ourselves to the work of this year is really to, seek to cooperate with this place that's called Ipsissimus, most deeply myself, most truly myself. And what could help in a way is this image of this card where this card, the Lovers, is just worth spending time just looking at, really, because it holds the kind of relationship of the work. At the deepest place, we've got this image of the sun, the source, if you like, of our being. We could say that's that place right at the deepest place of the tree, and it just shines, right? It's an inexhaustible source of energy, more powerful than anything else. Now, from the sun emerges the angel, and the angel is holding everything. Its hands are extended in benediction over the man and the woman in the picture. The man, which represents, in a sense, our outer, more kind of cognitive sense, has to look towards the woman, has to look towards the anima, the soul figure, the more intuitive side. And that intuitive side is looking at the angel. In the background, we've got these two trees. We've got the tree of fire, and we've got the tree that is green and growing, and we've got the snake and the apple. And it sort of reminds us of this ancient story of Eden, of exile and return. Now, as we know, the Orthodox story of this is really about us. Is about the need to obey an external authority. Fern's powerful story about the little kids pleasing the people in the church and the good little boy giving all the answers really shows somewhere the power of that external story and how that story is still running in us. Okay? And it's deeply connected to the place where we think we're doing it wrong. Or we think we're outside, the good energy is somewhere else, not in us. We are the sinners, we're the people who can't quite make it work. Whereas actually this card is about the return to the garden. It's about the bringing together of the tree of fire and the tree that is green of leaf. It's about bringing together the man and the woman. It's about entering into the guidance of the angel and connecting again to the sun, to the source of our being. In a way, it is being the tree of life in the center of the garden. The other thing to do over the month is to spend time just looking at this image of the tree in the garden. The image is a nice one because it connects very easily with the principal image we worked with last year, which was the mound in the forest. Because in a sense, the tree is growing out of the mound. So what we're doing, in a way, is having spent a lot of time going down and down and down, is looking at that, the connection between down and up and all around. lots and lots of things that can come out of that picture. We've got the desert land, we've got the green land, we've got fire and water, we've got stone, we've got space. There's a lot of elements that we can kind of contemplate when we're looking at that. We're just taking an initial look at it just this weekend. The other things that we've looked at, again, just taking beginning looks at things. We've started to look at something, at a whole imaginative discipline called the discipline of the body of light. Now that's a slightly different approach to working with the imagination, where normally we just go in and we explore the inside world. In this place, we form or we center ourselves in an imagination body and step out of that to explore the imaginal component of the world around us. And we're going to continue to work with this. And initially we just looked at the imaginal component of this room and the building. But then we started to look at the experience of Glastonbury as an imaginal location, as a sort of place in the collective unconscious. So we make this journey to Glastonbury Abbey, and we encounter, if you like, the archetypal abbey. It'll be slightly different every time we come across it, but it's this, underneath the surface of things, is this powerful archetypal image. And the over the year, we're going to explore other aspects of the archetypes of Glastonbury. We've got the Tor and the Hill, we've got the Chalice Well, we've got the Two Springs, we have Bridget's Well. You know, there's a whole, this is a very myth-laden environment. So we're going to, it's interesting to connect to in its own right, because it's kind of quite powerful, but it also starts to give us a handle or a relationship with the idea of the collective imagination and what Jung called the collective unconscious. So we're looking also at working with collective images, collective experience. The other figure that we mentioned, but we'll come back to, is the figure of Ibn Arabi, who, medieval Sufi, who was one of the greatest teachers of inner work and the imagination the world has ever seen, and who, Ibn Arabi.
Ibn Arabi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I seem to have lost the ability to write. That's a shame, isn't it? Ibn. IBN.
Yeah.
Arabi. Arab with an I at the end. Ibn Arabi. Born in Andalusia. So European. A great spiritual teacher. And teaches about the ipsity of being, the oneness, the likeness of all being to everything else. Connected, you know, the word that connects again to this word ipsissimus, my own true self. Ibn Arabi is one of the great forgotten teachers of the West. He is the Sufi who worked with the divine feminine, who is a direct inspirer of Dante and Dante's. Of course, is the great, because there's this great image of Beatrice as the divine, as the inspirer and divine figure that leads him through the Commedia, to eventually to God. So there's a whole layer of teaching, if you like, that Ibn Arabi can help us with, which is about both the specificity of the imagination and its universal nature. You know, the imagination is not Celtic, it's not Egyptian, it's not Arab, it's human. So what Ibn Arabi was very good at looking at is the capacity of the our will and imagination to work with any and every form. And I think one of the strange things is that at the moment is that he's buried in Damascus, and of course his grave, which has been a pilgrimage site for hundreds of years, is right at the heart of one of the great nodes of human difficulty at the moment. You know, the sort of war that's raging in Syria, that's affecting the whole world. You know, it's drawn America and Russia into confrontation again. You know, and Turkey, yeah. Terrible things happening in Turkey. There's the rise of the old Islamic caliphate. So the thing about these ancient images, and the reason why it's important to study them, is if they're not worked with and understood consciously, they drive people from behind. This is Jung's great discovery. You know, he has this just before the First World War happened. He has this dream of the German hero Siegfried being killed, and a great tide of blood sweeping across Europe. And this is before the sort of assassination in Sarajevo. You know, so he's tapping into something that's about to happen later. And this in between the First and Second World Wars, he has these dreams of the ancient German war god Wotan being woken from his sleep, and of course, you know, what he's pointing at there is how the ancient images, if they're not worked with in consciousness, actually possess people and create havoc in our world. I mean, one of the things I remember, my own experience of listening to a program about Radovan Karadžić, when he was seen as one of the exemplars of the new Europe breaking free of the USSR, breaking free out of the communist Yugoslavia. And there was a program that was, fating him as a poet, psychiatrist, the new kind of leader for a new Europe. And one of the things I remember was he and his mates were up a mountain, and they were singing these songs about how the white eagle of Serbia would rise again to drive out the Turk. And I feel it now, so it was like this chill going up my back, and I couldn't understand why. It felt like, because on the face of it, these are a few boys just singing old songs, and it felt there's something really chilling and frightening about it. And of course, he and his mates later go on to try and drive out the Turk and commit appalling ethnic cleansing. So there's something very important about this ability to engage with the ancient archetypes that arise from the very deep levels of human consciousness, human unconsciousness, rather, I suppose. And there's a whole process of work of working with that that helps free ourselves, but it can also help us to free others from these potent old images of hate and despair. And crucial to that is the embodiment of the archetype of the human being. Because the human being, in a way, is the bridge, is the person who can connect with opposites and bring them into the heart and alchemize them in the heart, so that opposites and old hatreds, old wounds can make peace with each other. And so the work that we're looking at in some ways is an alchemical work of transformation which involves the creation of a vessel that can hold the work, that can bring the energies of fire and water into the material that needs transformation, that can galvanize a stuck situation. And through processes of distillation or of tempering, of temperance, can help something new come out of old and broken places. Now it all connects up with the work that we've done last year, because the work on the poem is all about moving through places to free the prisoner, to connect us to this place of being pen and inventor, being the generative source. So what we're doing with this idea is I was taking it beyond the boundaries of the poem and taking the using some other frameworks of the same work that we've done last year, but we're now doing it more intensively. And really starting to look at, well, okay, how do we stop ourselves in this? How do we relax more deeply into the flow of this? What happens when we bring our will and imagination together? What's our will like anyway? And there's an alchemical text we will look at called Eshmesaraf, which is called the refining or purifying fire, which is all about the transformation of the will. It comes out of a biblical story where, oddly, there's a lot of Syrian references in my work at the moment, where Naaman, who is the warrior of the king of Syria, who has become a leper, who has got leprosy, comes to the prophet Elisha to be healed. And Naaman, in a way, represents the will the diseased will. He's this man of war who carries the sword, and he represents, he's the red man. He carries this kind of fiery, focused, willful kind of energy. And leprosy is a really particular illness, because leprosy means you become insensitive. You know, the scabs and the sores you see in leprosy, not because of the body rotting, it's because the pain receptors of the body switch off. So if you hurt yourself, you're not aware that you've hurt yourself. And so you continually get abraded by life and can't. And it's because you have lost sensitivity. Now, Naaman is the image of the will that has lost flexibility, has lost sensitivity, is fixed, a fixed sort of will. And how Elisha kind of heals him is he tells him that he should immerse himself in the River Jordan. And he's furious at being told this because it feels too easy and a bit too ridiculous. And actually, you know, he wants powerful cleansing rituals, and he wants the prophet to bless him. And Elisha says, no, just immerse yourself 7 times in the Jordan. And the Jordan is the river that flows from north to south, that connects the Red Sea and the White and the Salt Sea, the red and the white. It's an image of opposites, of you immerse yourself in the flow. In a sense, we immerse ourselves in the flow that comes from here and there. So when we come into the middle pillar of the tree and we come into the process, we're having to dip ourselves in a way in the River Jordan and let that really soak into us. So we bring the opposites together. And then the significance of the 7 times symbolically means the 7 alchemical processes. So and it's rather like the 7 kairas that you go through in the poem. You go through a whole series of cyclic processes that gradually loosen our will, free it from its fixations, and enable it to be actively responsive to where we are here and now. So that's what we're going to do.
Just like that.
Just like that.
In a year.
Yeah. Some of it, anyway.
Live sessions.
8 to go.
8 more, actually. No, we've got only agreement. We've just done one of them.
Yeah, it's going to be hard.
Yeah. So it's going to be hard. Oh, yeah. It's going to be hard. And we will. So thanks a lot.